This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. The Russian Defense Ministry says it has repelled Ukraine's attack on the Crimean port city of Sevastopol, which is home to Russia's Black Sea Fleet. Israelis have taken to the streets for the 28th week in a row to voice their opposition to judicial overhaul plans proposed by PM Netanyahu. Also in the headlines, record temperatures are scorching parts of Asia, Europe, and the U.S., as forecasts warn of a dangerous heat wave around the world. Thanks for joining us. The Russian Defense Ministry says it has repelled Ukraine's attack on the Crimean port city of Sevastopol. The ministry in a statement said that it destroyed 7 aerial and 2 underwater drones that were trying to attack targets in and around the city. It said no casualties or damage were caused. Sevastopol rejoined Russia in 2014 after a referendum. The city is home to Russia's Black Sea Fleet. It has been the scene of drone attacks by Ukraine since the breakout of the war in February of last year. Our correspondent in Moscow, Johnny Miller, says Sunday's attack on Sevastopol was one of the largest ones since the beginning of the war.
This is one of the largest attacks since the war began last year. As you say, aerial drones, water drones, some footage coming out of Russia destroying these drones, sometimes even with small arms fire. So we think there's been no damage to the Russian Black Sea Fleet. Ukraine have had very little success with these attacks. Crimea, and particularly Sevastopol, is one of the places in the world with the strongest air defense because of Russia's fleet there. So another attempt by Ukraine to damage the fleet, and may well be connected to the ending of the grain deal as well. We're seeing increasing escalation on the battlefield, still little talk of peace. But particularly as this Ukrainian counteroffensive looks like it's failing, there is hope that we'll see more signs of peace now, but not happening at the moment.
Russia warns Ukraine against the use of cluster munitions against Moscow, saying it is ready to retaliate with the same type of weapons. In an interview with Russian media, President Vladimir Putin said that his country has a sufficient stockpile of various kinds of cluster munitions. He said Moscow reserves the right to tit-for-tat actions. Putin also said Russia has not used such weapons despite a certain shortage of munitions at some point. Ukraine has recently started receiving cluster weapons from the U.S. Washington's decision was opposed by many countries, including the U.S. allies. The EU Council President says peace and normalization between Azerbaijan and Armenia can be achieved by stopping violence and harsh rhetoric.
As a matter of priority, violence and harsh rhetoric should stop in order to provide a proper environment for peace and normalization talks. I also reiterated my intention to invite the Armenian and Azerbaijani leaders for another meeting in Brussels after the summer, as well as for another pentalateral meeting with the participation also of the leaders of France and Germany in Grenada in the margins of the next European Community Summit.
Mitchell said the current state of affairs is clearly not sustainable and in no one's interest. He made the remarks after trilateral talks with Azerbaijani and Armenian presidents. In the meeting, they discussed possible steps to help bring the situation back to normal in the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. This comes as Russia offered to host the two countries' foreign ministers and suggested a future peace treaty could be signed in Moscow. The Nagorno-Karabakh region has been at the center of a decades-long dispute between the two countries, which have fought 2 wars over the mountainous territory. The region is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but has a primarily Armenian population. The Israeli army has fired tear gas towards a Lebanese member of parliament who was touring an area near the Israeli-occupied Sheba farms. The Lebanese lawmaker, Qasem Hashem, was accompanied by a group of journalists. Several people, including Hashem, have reportedly been injured. Israeli forces demanded that journalists leave the area, despite the fact that they were in Lebanon's territory. The area near Lebanon's southern border has recently witnessed tensions after Israeli occupation forces erected a barbed wire fence and constructed a concrete wall around the entire occupied village of Al-Hajar. More than 100,000 Israelis have flocked the streets of Tel Aviv to protest for the 28th consecutive week against the controversial reforms advanced by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's hard-right coalition. Now, in Tel Aviv, protesters unrolled a massive banner reading SOS while blocking major highways and disrupting operations. Protesters brandished lit torches outside of Netanyahu's home and demonstrated in the coastal cities of Herzliya and Netanya. The mass protests are gaining momentum as the Israeli parliament gave initial approval to a key portion of the overhaul earlier this week. The legislation package would roll back some of the Supreme Court's powers and give the ruling coalition decisive sway in picking judges. The bill still needs to be approved in two more votes expected by the end of the month before it becomes law. Israel's labor union and medical association, military reservists, fighter pilots, and business leaders, as well as the regime's allies, namely the U.S., have all called for the halt of the plan. Protest leaders promise further days of disruption lie ahead. Author and journalist Robert Fantina says the controversial reforms introduced by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu could lead to strikes like the one which happened back in March.
The strike that happened last March is probably going to be called again if things continue. This will decimate the Israeli economy. Now, Israel is self-destructing as we watch it, and that's not a bad thing, certainly. But one thing that's important is that the Israelis, people who are demonstrating against injustices that are going to be perpetrated upon them. They don't care about the injustices that are being and have been perpetrated on the Palestinians for decades. It's the idea that they're going to be negatively impacted, and they're Israelis, they're Zionists, and they won't put up with this. So, but Netanyahu is holding fast against huge numbers of his people, against all of Israel's allies, but he's still maintaining this desire for this judicial overhaul. They want to be able to violate current laws and international law with complete impunity. They want to be able to basically commit genocide against the Palestinian people, and there has been minimal restrictions of that over the years, but they want to remove those minimal restrictions and just have free reign to do whatever they want to for Zionist Israelis and everyone else be damned. And this is what basically is going to be the outcome of this overhaul.
Shooting attack near an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank has left three Israelis wounded. Let's cross on over to Ramallah to hear more about the attack from our correspondent, Mona Kandil, who joins us. Mona, tell us about this latest incident that has occurred. What do you have for us?
The Israeli military said that three Israelis were wounded. One of them was shot and he's in serious critical condition. The two other settlers were wounded by the shrapnel or the broken windows of a vehicle. What happened, according to the Israeli military, a vehicle arrived at the Tekoa checkpoint between Beit Lahem in South Occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, and at least one Palestinian opened fire at the Israeli vehicle, shooting one, and the two others were wounded, maybe from the broken glass of the vehicle or from shrapnel. The man or the shooter, whom Israelis say he is a Palestinian, succeeded to flee the area, and he's still at large. the Israeli military is still searching for this vehicle and the shooter. The Israeli military then claimed that they believe at least two Palestinians were inside this vehicle. Immediately, the Israeli occupation forces closed off all the entrances leading to Bethlehem, and also the checkpoints northeast of Bethlehem that separates the south of the occupied West Bank from its center. All the roads leading from Bethlehem and Al-Khalil, south occupied West Bank, to Al-Quds had been completely closed. There is a warning from the Israeli military that this vehicle or the Palestinians inside it might succeed to flee to the areas in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. And this will make the mission of the Israeli forces to raid Al-Khalil and arrest this Palestinian or the group of Palestinians would be even difficult. Hamas movement issued a statement following the operation, praising this operation, saying that the resistance in the occupied West Bank is expanding. And what's going on, this operation and the similar operations are simply a response and a natural response to the non-stop Israeli crimes against the Palestinians across the occupied West Bank. The spokesman of the Hamas movement also says that every time the Palestinian resistance is surprising the Israeli military and the Israeli regime in the place and the method of execution, speaking about these operations, and that the resistance will continue until the goals of the Palestinian people are achieved.
Mona, quickly, if you can, we know that recently there was a law that was passed by Israel that is scrapping the confiscation of Palestinians' weapons when they shoot, the Israeli regime forces to confiscate what the old law was of the Palestinians when they were being shot at by settlers. And that law has now been revoked. Is there a sense that you get that the settlers are now getting the feeling that they can actually go out and use their weapons against Palestinians more so than before?
In the area of the elite, whether mainly the northern occupied West Bank, like Nablus, Jenin, Tulkarem, and Qalqilia, these areas are very close to the illegal settlements, and it's well known that the settlers all across the occupied West Bank are armed settlers. Let us remind our viewers what happened in the village of Umm Safa, in Tel Musa'iyya, and Sinjar last month. Israeli settlers, using their arms, they raided the Palestinian villages and towns, and they used their weapons against Palestinians. A number of people had been wounded, and they were backed by the Israeli forces. When the Palestinians tried to defend themselves, there were the Israeli soldiers making sure that the settlers were safe. They used their arms by themselves also, and in order to disperse the protesters and in order to make sure that the settlers can come out from these Palestinian villages safe and sound. So yes, maybe the Israeli settlers can even escalate their use of the weapons in their weapons in other areas across the occupied West Bank, and they could use it in the areas near Bethlehem and Al-Khalil. We have to see that in Al-Khalil, the settlements there are the extremist settlers. They are well known for being far-right settlers, extremists, the most aggressive settlers in the occupied West Bank.
Thank you for that. Mona Kandil, talking to us from occupied Ramallah. Thank you, Mona. Moving on, Iraq's prime minister has left Baghdad for Damascus, heading a high-ranking delegation. During his official visit, Mohammed Shia Sabar al-Sudani is to sit down with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. They are to discuss border security and war on terror, among other things. This is the first trip to Syria by an Iraqi prime minister since the year 2010, when the former Iraqi premier Nouri al-Maliki had traveled to Damascus. Four countries moving away from the U.S. dollar as India and the UAE agree to settle trade in their national currencies. The agreement was signed during a visit by India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi to the UAE capital, Abu Dhabi. India's Reserve Bank says their arrangement will enable the development of a foreign exchange market between the Indian rupee and the UAE dirham. In recent years, there has been an accelerating trend toward de-dollarization. Last month, the U.S. Treasury Secretary said Washington should expect a gradual decline in the dollar's share of the global reserve. Janet Yellen acknowledged that the U.S. use of sanctions has motivated some countries to look for alternative currencies. Okay, moving on, some climate change news. Record temperatures scorching parts of Asia, Europe, and the U.S. as forecasts warn of a dangerous heat wave around the world in the weekend. Now, the U.S. National Weather Service has warned of a, quote, extremely hot and dangerous weekend with risk to life. This is amid a heat wave that is exposing over 100 million people in the south to temperatures of up to 48 degrees Celsius. Historic highs are also being reported in Europe. Italy is being hit the hardest. It has issued red alerts for 16 cities, with temperatures forecast at 48 degrees Celsius in Sicily and in Sardinia. That would be an all-time record high in Europe. Record heat is also searing Asia. It has triggered temperature alerts in Japan and in China. Meanwhile, wildfires in Canada have burnt more than 10 million hectares this year. That's a record-breaking figure, which will continue to rise in the coming weeks. That's according to government data. The country has seen a total of more than 4,000 fires since January. 900 of those are still active. The scale of the fires and their multitude have forced authorities not to intervene and let the majority burn. Many of the fires are far from inhabited areas. However, more than 150,000 people have been displaced, and a firefighter died on Thursday. In the U.S., the smoke blown in from the wildfires have caused hazy skies and dangerous air quality. Experts have warned that cities like Chicago and New York may soon have the worst air quality in the world. On to South Korea, where at least seven bodies have been discovered from a flooded tunnel, as days of heavy rain have caused deadly floods and landslides in the country. At least 15 vehicles have been trapped in muddy waters in an underpass in the central city of Cheongju. Rescue operation is underway to find people still remain trapped in the tunnel. The latest fatalities have brought the total death toll to at least 33. Most of the other deaths have happened in the North Gyeongsang region, where landslides have destroyed whole homes. South Korea has been hit by heavy rainfall since July 9, which has intensified in recent days. It has caused flooding, landslides, and power cuts across much of the country. And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks so much for being with us. This is bye-bye for now.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking under the seas of the planet. The Baltic Sea, the most polluted sea in the world, is rife with tons of highly toxic and explosive cocktails of chemical weapons inherited from two world wars, which threaten us today. Stay with us for the second part of the documentary as we go across the Atlantic to see the legacy of two world wars all around the United States coast.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist fishing vessels that have caught chemical combinations. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
We're in Lahnfurt, Germany. This is where the pipeline comes out of the Baltic Sea, and this is where the gas enters the European gas grid. The munitions issue meant that we had to do extensive detailed surveys. Once the alignments of the pipelines were defined, we then did the detailed munitions surveys. We did very high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys, magnetometer surveys, and bathymetric surveys. And then within the installation corridor, so that's where the pipeline could touch the seabed, we did gradiometer survey works and visual inspections. And out of those, we identified over 400 munitions along the pipeline route. To allow us to have a safe corridor, we had to clear munitions within plus or minus 25 meters of the Nord Stream pipelines. So prior to the installation, we cleared munitions through using detonation techniques in the Gulf of Finland and in Russia. And in Germany, we lifted the munitions that we found close to the route. We had located a number of chemical munitions, and these were avoided.
The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s, of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and Lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites, or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
In the wake of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called upon the Army to increase its efforts to locate dump sites. That work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons arsenal.
My work here has been mostly archival research on when we started, why we started, where we started dumping chemical munitions. White binders are pretty much all of the information that in the last 5 years we've been able to find on the chemical weapons disposals and some conventional in U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together in many, many instances because you find a piece of correspondence, say, that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable. They cannot be reconditioned. So you've got that piece of paper, okay, but all of a sudden you'll get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. I go, wait a minute, now I know what they did with them. And, whoa, we've got the boat. So we go and we find the logbook. And hopefully the captain put in the latlongs. You know, how long did it take him and when he went back to shore. Anytime that you find something that matches up, it's like I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces. How long would that take you to put together? I don't know. Don't want to find out.
William Brankovitz was the first to chart U.S. chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense Department in the 1980s.
Part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons, as did the Russians. And we all share some of that legacy today. Some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for exploitation to be looked at and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was, again, thought to be excess to anyone's needs. So a great many of those chemical weapons were taken out to sea and were sea disposed at the time. That pretty much continued right into the 1960s. And in the 1960s, people became concerned about, is this really the way to get rid of chemical weapons? There were a series of chemical weapons disposals that were planned at the end of the 1960s in an operation called Operation Chase. The last one was under a great deal of controversy. By that time, everyone had started to realize that there were potential problems. And so the Army asked the National Academy of Sciences in 1969 to take a look at this problem and do a study and see what the best way was of doing this disposal action. They issued it, and it basically said, due to the fact that we don't know completely how the fate of this material is resolved on the ocean floor, we recommend that you stop sea disposing of chemical weapons. And we moved away at that point in time completely from ocean disposal of chemical weapons. I think about 2 years later, in 1972, there was a congressional act that made it illegal.
The Pentagon began a pilot program to study environmental effects off the coast of Hawaii, where it dumped tons of conventional and chemical munitions over the decades.
I think we've all learned things, that the ocean is not a garbage dump. And if you dump something into the ocean, it does have environmental effects. When you understand that today we're taking a look to see what those effects are, we're looking at the fish, we're looking at the other biota in the sea to see what effect it has had to determine whether removal is an appropriate course of action. What is down there has been down there 30, 40, 50 or more years, in some cases 80 years. There's a lot of work the environment has done on these munitions, and that work has been to slowly dissolve them and absorb them. And when we're not finding an adverse impact to health, life, safety, leave in place is continuing to be the right solution. I'm not saying that we won't find a location where we make a different decision. But when we're using a science-based approach, we really want there to be an understanding of the effect on the environment, an understanding on the effect on people, and an understanding of what happens when we bring it up out of the water. Is that really the safest, most risk-averse manner of handling this?
The United States and Great Britain have extended official secrecy until 2017. And for the last 60 years, scientific research on chemical weapons in the sea and the dangers they pose has been limited because of this military control. Canada launched a big effort to dispose of chemical weapons during World War II. One retired Army mine clearing expert has combined environmental concern with an entrepreneurial approach and become a crusader for cleanup.
Good afternoon, I'm Wendy Bergfeld, and this is Bain Street. And on today's program, a conversation with Terry Long, a former military engineer, an explosive ordnance disposal expert, more than 30 years experience, and he is sounding the alarm. Our conversation on today's edition of Main Street.
I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and I grew up here. Cape Breton Island is an island. We have a big lake in the middle of it called the Bedore Lakes. It's a very beautiful island, pristine in some areas. When you start looking at in the Bedore Lakes, there's actually five munition sites, and one is a chemical weapons disposal site from after the Second World War. Johnstown was used for a chemical weapons facility. Everything was secret. They didn't want people to know that this was actually being manufactured here. It was the same thing after the war when they started to look at decommissioning. It was basically just tear down the structures and leave it. And there was, again, no knowledge that it was a chemical weapons site, so nobody would suspect anything there at all. So when I started looking at that, I started feeling compelled that I had to do something to protect our lake. And then when I started looking outside of Nova Scotia, again, I was getting shocked. All these different munition sites all along the eastern seaboard, all along the west coast of Canada, and all around the world, from the Baltic Sea to the Sea of Japan. The first thing I did is I did a Canadian Senate hearing, and I took the First Nations of Wagobok with me so we could actually talk about it from the perspective of First Nations, as them being the keeper of Mother Earth. So at the Senate hearing, we discussed the different sites, what some of the contaminants are. Two recommendations came out. The first was the United Nations should have an international conference to address sea dump munitions. The second was is we needed to develop a stakeholders group that encompassed everybody to actually look at the effects from the munitions. So what happened is because there was no international conference, I developed the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions, and that became the international platform for munitions.
My name is Albert Marshall, and I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kma'ki, the Mi'kmaq territory, back during the war. We used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Bedore Lakes. Terry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had, because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6-7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Bedore Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factoring our 7 generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Bedore Lakes, but they haven't denied it either. And for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas.
Well,
Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced here at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kanda experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. One million tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons. And many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea. Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support cleanup efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea-dumped chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us.
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? We cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of sea-dump chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. كتاب الله.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثتو لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, dear listeners, sisters and brothers, the loyal family of IRIB English Radio. There is a beautiful story of a beggar who lived all of his life under one tree. Each day he would go out into the village and beg for some dry breadcrumbs to sustain his life. For 40 years, the beggar lived under the same tree, pleading with the people to give him some food. Day by day, he became weaker, and finally one day he passed quietly into death. When the villagers found him, they decided to bury his ashes under the tree where he lived out his life. As they began to dig in order to place his ashes deep in the ground, they found a treasure chest, a chest full of gold, diamonds, and jewels, a mere 6 inches below the ground. Well, this was just the opening to a new episode of For a Better Life. Just like always, I remind you of the very fact that I'm not going to teach you anything. I'm in love with literature, and analyzing the stuff and commenting on them is one of my most favorite things to do. So, yes, this is IRIB English Radio, and I hope you're doing well whenever you are. So, it hasn't been so long, so you should remember the story that I told you at the very beginning of today's episode. It was about a beggar who spent his entire life begging for things without knowing that underneath him, just underneath the ground that he was sitting, rest so much of diamonds and gold and things like that, a treasure, just like the treasures that we human beings search for every now and then in our lives. Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Yeah, Allah, yeah, Allah, be with me far the way. Yes, too frequently in life, we are also like this beggar running here and there, searching, begging for that which we need to fulfill our lives. We are searching and yearning for peace, happiness, and God. We go here, we go there, we search this place, we search that place, but that priceless and crucial peace and happiness still eludes us. If only we would sit still for a moment and go deeper within and never forget that the treasure chest is inside of us, flowing through our veins. It is not some external thing to be obtained or found. Rather, we could say that the divine joy that we're searching for is in our heart, in our breath, and in our blood. We have it in a Persian poem that says that the treasure that you're seeking for rests inside of you. And that's the very truth about life. We go here and there in pursuit of happiness, in pursuit of prosperity, but we do not know that the main and the most important prosperity and treasure is inside of ourselves. The things that we're seeking for most of the time are the things that are in front of us, but we do not notice them. We do not see them as if we're blind. We turn a blind eye to every single one of those treasures just because we think happiness or prosperity is somewhere else, while we're very much wrong. Life is all about these little, very tiny moments and details that we spent with our family. We spent of our lifetime, of course, even if it's not doing anything, even if it's just a soul-searching drama, even if it's just getting into the fields or going into a village, watching the surroundings, watching the skies, watching the lakes, watching all the beautiful things, a single small butterfly that comes and sits on your finger. So all of these little tiny things are considered the treasures, because every single one of them are going to sparkle something new into your brain and are going to bring some new manifestations into your thoughts. And then just as those moments of manifestation happen, you might be an inventor, you might turn into a writer, you might write a poem, you might do big and great things, you might start to find a new medicine if you're a student of medicine. Then just by a moment of relief and by a moment of going deep into your thought in peace of mind, you could get to find the remedies for all the diseases that exist in today's world. So these are not stories and miracles that we talk about. These are just the normal life, even, let me just say, the ordinary life, that we should learn how to, you know, seize it, how to understand it, how to make the most out of it, how to feel happy and content with every moment of it. So I guess right now is the best time for us to go for a little bit of a change of mood, and then we'll be back. So don't go anywhere.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Being content with what you have already is an art form. It leads to peace that can't be replaced by anything else. So this is IRB English Radio. You are listening to For a Better Life. I am Asma, and we're talking about life. I have seen this movie about the pursuit of happiness. I guess everybody has seen that, and it's been long ago that's been released, so it is one of the classics by now. The thing that really enchanted my thought and idea was the fact that really we did not give it a thought. Life is just the moments that are fleeting, and the thing that we search for, it lays in front of our eyes and we just do not see it. The fact that you have a family, the fact that you're healthy, the fact that you can work so hard to get what you want is a blessing. That is the happiness. And, you know, the modern life has got too many problems within itself. One of those problems is the fact that people think if they have more money, they're going to be more prosperous and happier. But it's wrong, because there are many wealthy people. I hate to sound like so idealistic people and those kind of people who say things that they do not believe in it. But trust me, whatever I say in here, whatever I share in these monologues are the things that I think about them and I believe in them, because you cannot preach people the things you're not practicing. I guess that's a fact. I cannot say things I do not myself believe in. So, yeah, happiness is the smile of my father and my mother. Happiness is the health that I have. And happiness is the family time that we sit together. So when you sit alone with yourself, try to ask some questions like this from yourself. What is happiness according to me? What are the things that I would consider as happiness in my life? And what are the things that I cannot live without? Sometimes we're not going to get the meaning of life unless we lose the life that we already are living in it and we're a part of it. But since we're living in the hustles and bustles of these busy life that we're living, sometimes we just forget to count them or be thankful from Allah for giving all of these blessings to me as one person. So now that I can breathe easily, now that I am considered as the healthy people who can live with their family, who can see the smile of their parents, of their siblings, of their loved ones, so I am happy and I am prosperous. And all the happiness that I'm searching for in this world just exists in me. I shouldn't just search for it in another place of the world. I suppose everything starts from within. Just go for your insight and then try to count the blessings that you have, and then you would see where the true happiness is resting. Yes, we are running out of time. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I had and every word I shared.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.